Welcome to A Cult of Personality at acultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
This is A Cult of Personality podcast episode number 120, featuring an interview with Tal Allen Greenfield about Congregational Illuminism. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky. Thank you for listening. Support for A Cult of Personality podcast comes from the subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section, as well as all those generous listeners from all over the world who click the donate button on the occultofpersonality.net website to sponsor this episode. Thanks again to Steve in the UK, Lance in Massachusetts, Michal in Slovakia, Trina, Neil, Adela, and Shadowlit Productions. The 2012 Esoteric Book Conference will take place in Seattle, Washington on September 15th and 16th. Tickets are available through their website at esotericbookconference.com. I look forward to seeing you there. One note on upcoming recordings already in production. We have Richard Kaczynski talking about his excellent biography of Aleister Crowley entitled Perdurabo, Jocelyn Godwin and the Forbidden Book, Joseph Thebus discussing AC 2012 and Thelema, and Timothy Hogan on his wonderful book, Entering the Chain of Union. Please check back for those outstanding interviews in the coming weeks. Now, in podcast episode number 120, Tal Allen Greenfield returns to the show. He previously appeared in A Cult of Personality podcast episodes numbers 17, 31, 35, 43, and 57. You can find Tal Allen online by Googling his name, Allen Greenfield, and the link to his website, The Assembly and Knowledge and Wisdom of Solomon, is in the show notes. From his bio on Wikipedia, Allen H. Greenfield, also known by his ecclesiastical name, Tal Sir Hasserim, is an American occultist, ceremonial magician, ufologist, writer, editor, and Gnostic bishop of Ecclesia Gnostica Universalis, who resides in Atlanta, Georgia. His book, The Story of the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light, is one of the few sources of information on this subject. His book, The Complete Rite of Memphis, is a comprehensive history of an Egyptian rite of Freemasonry, and he edited an authorized, annotated edition of the work Liber 31 by Charles Stanfield Jones. He was elected and consecrated a bishop by the Holy Synod of the Neo-Pythagorean Gnostic Church in 1986. In 1987, he was extended recognition as a bishop within the Ecclesia Gnostica Catholica and was consecrated in New York in November 1988. Allen also helps to facilitate the work of Congregational Illuminism, the subject of this interview. Tal Allen Greenfield, welcome back to the show. It is a pleasure to speak with you again.
I'm delighted to be on, Greg.
And it's been a little while, or more than a little while, since we last spoke. I want to talk with you about a topic that I think is near and dear to both of our hearts, if I might be so bold, and that's Congregational Illuminism.
Right. I'm not sure exactly how long it's been since we last did a program specifically devoted to that. I think it was a roundtable discussion, but it's been a couple of years. And the growth of Congregational Illuminism in that period is astonishing. If we judge at all by the Facebook Causes group, it has grown to well over 2,000 members. In fact, it's getting close to hitting 2,100 from all over the world, which is just unheard of for the type of group that it is. We have over 60 local bodies in, I haven't counted, but I'd say 25 different countries. It's definitely an idea whose time has come. Craig Heimbichner, in his new book, said something about why go to Masonic meetings and other groups of that sort when you can join Congregational Illuminism just by pressing a button on Facebook. But I like to think that there are those people who just want to show sympathy with the notion of a free approach to illumination. But there are many people who want to get actively involved in a non-hierarchical approach to magic, the occult, mysticism, etc., that don't just want to push a button, and they have gotten involved in local bodies, and including two in the area that I live in that are very active. And of course, there's a whole group of people who are, call them nodes, but basically individual congregational illuminists that now something like, I guess it's 6 years we've been engaged in the Great Arabia Mountain working, and go to Mount Arabia in Cab County, Georgia, and do a lot of experimental pre-shod or point shod or hot points workings. And we get large crowds, and it's grown a lot from the two or three people that we started out with. So I would say that it's an idea that definitely is a here and now thing.
Thank you for that introduction. Now,
I don't know of any movement in the occult community that has grown that much that fast. I mean, I'm something of an historian of the occult movement, at least since 1700. I just don't know of any. The Golden Dawn at its peak had, I think, 250 members. And to reach this kind of membership numbers took, say, the Caliphate OTO, which, you know, had a, I don't know, shall we say, it had a reputation to build on, for better or worse. It took them, I'm trying to calculate, 30-some-odd years from the time they reactivated themselves to reach that kind of numbers, and I'm not sure that they even have that kind of numbers anymore.
Hmm. Well, for people who don't know, we should probably talk a little bit more in terms of background information, and I'd like to ask you about what are the historical origins of Congregational Illuminism in terms of your personal experience with it?
I have to be kind of careful about this because there are people who seem to think that I created Congregational Illuminism whole cloth after I parted ways with the Caliphate OTO. And that is definitely not the case. I'll definitely cop to having created the term as such, but the I would say for the last 10 years and, well, not longer than that, for the last dozen years, and even longer than that, if you count the history of the order QBLH, which is, as far as I know, only minimally active at this point in time, but which influenced me a lot. It sort of had a congregational luminous basis without using that term, going back to its founding in 1960. Another source, I think one that specifically is an outgrowth of the Ecclesia Gnostica, is the, which is an internal, ecclesiastical arm of the, COTO. Some people who were discontented with the, relegation of that to being basically a part of their degree system hived off and founded an independent Gnostic communion called the Ecclesia Gnostica Universalis in the year 2000. And that, I think, would be In fact, it was July 4th, 2000. And I think that would be the closest thing you could get to a beginning of the Congregational Illuminist movement. Then sometime during that same period, and I'm hazy on the time, but there had long been inside the EGC within the OTO, there had been people who'd been experimenting sort of offline with what are called heretical Gnostic masses. And eventually some of those people hived off altogether from the OTO. Again, I had nothing whatever to do with this. I really only became aware of it after, I guess around the time I left the OTO, the Caliphate OTO, since there are other claimants. A guy named Mort Shapiro, who goes by Baal Kriya on LiveJournal, or at least used to, formed something he called Congregational Polema. And they started to do Liber 15 Gnostic Masses, but not under the control of the Caliphate OTO. And they had been doing that for some time. I became aware of it, and by that point I had reached a kind of mixed feeling about the term polema. I thought that it was so closely associated with the hierarchical structure of the OTO and the alleged AA succession that is allied with it, that I tended not to use the term because it sort of poisoned the well, which is a double entendre to those who know, before the conversation really got underway. And so I figured that the thing that all of these tendencies had in common was that they were attempting, without having a rigid dogma or hierarchy or set of oaths to living human beings or charging for spiritual services or whatever, that the object was illumination in the sense that scientific illuminism means using scientific principles to reach higher states of illumination through various techniques, ranging from mystery play initiations to consecratory means to yoga, for that matter, various schools of yoga, that the thing in common would be that they were in free association, in free communion. And I came up with the term Congregational Illuminism around 2004, 2005. And the term spread out and eventually became as close to, quote, official, unquote, as you can get in a configuration which really isn't an organization, certainly not a corporation, and has no leaders as such. I'm sure some people are more influential than others, and by definition, some people are more knowledgeable than others. But basically, it's a free communion. So Congregational Illuminism seemed to fit it. The only drawback to that is that some people take the Illuminism part and think that we're claiming to be the Bavarian Illuminati, and lots of people don't like that and have very strange ideas about that. And that's certainly not what we're doing. Is at least I'm not doing that. And the other part of it is congregational is often associated with a given religion, and we definitely are not that. It, I would say you would find every religion and every non-religion in the world of any size at all among the people who identify with Congregational Illuminism. It's a set of generalized principles, even those are not written in stone. They say in the Talmud, not written in black fire on white fire. I think that we have varying pictures of how to attain higher illumination, and that's reflected in local individuals, local bodies, different groups, but we support one another, each in their own way, and try to share our findings, good, bad, and otherwise.
So could you say a few words about the central tenets of Congregational Illuminism? Because I think that really sums up the philosophy pretty succinctly.
Well, I'm a little bit wary of the word central tenets, but let's just, I mean, central is a creepy word in our universe, but.
Right.
But in all seriousness, all of these are negotiable, but at some point, about 3 years into this, I tried to encapsulate what I was hearing as feedback from various people that were working in this configuration or movement, or call it what you will, except don't call it a corporation or a corporate entity. And I came up with 4 points. That spiritual growth is incompatible with authoritarian structure. For me, that's just based on experience. If you have a dogma at the top and a set of rigid principles that you are shooting for, you're sort of freezing people into one mode, and my experience has been everyone is an individual, and what applies to one may not apply to another at all. The second is scientific illuminism, which is the modus operandi, I guess you would say, of congregational illuminism, requires a non-dogmatic experimental approach. In every other magical configuration I've ever had anything to do with, they simply do what is handed down. They don't experiment in the same manner as, say, and my confessed model is paranormal scientific research, where you ask those basic questions like, does this really work? And if so, in what way? And if so, how? And if not, be sure to take note of that as well. The third principle, a free society linked in free communion should be actualized. Well, you can take that in the narrow sense of only being about the occult or metaphysical movement that Congregational Illuminism is, as opposed to the dogmatic and authoritarian and top-heavy organizations. Or you can take it as having applications to society as a whole and a broader spectrum as a whole. And I kind of take it both ways. I'm both a decentralist in the political sense and in the in terms of metaphysics as well. But you'll find a great variety of attitudes on that within Congregational Illuminism. And the last, very important, I think, when you compare us with other tendencies, we facilitate, we do not lead. We do the work, capital W, meaning the great work. We do not extract oaths or dues or require dogmatic beliefs. So you'll find great variation. And although when I charter a local body, which I've been empowered to do through various background circumstances, which is a whole story and probably a whole program in and of itself. But I have the hoodoo from a lot of older hoodoos, some of whom, you know, are coming from a very different place. But, you know, if they handed the hoodoo to me, I use it according to my lights. I prefer a term like facilitator or even facilitator general to the traditional term you see in Masonic circles of master, because I don't think anyone is hierarchically superior to other members. They may just be further along the path, and degrees or other forms of indication of progress are just that. They're analogous to college degrees. They're not analogous to administrative hierarchy, if that's clear. If not, I can elaborate further.
No, I think that's very clear. Thank you. The idea of a non-hierarchical group working together and individuals in that group, that loose association, they may be still working with all sorts of other modalities or practices, or some may even be involved in hierarchical organizations. Could you say a few words about that?
Yeah, we welcome anyone who's interested in what we're doing or trying to do. Now, I don't know the position of all of the organizations that work in the metaphysical field on being a congregational illuminist, but I can tell you that there are two categories, notable categories of people who are involved in very hierarchical structures and in congregational illuminism, and I understand and am empathetic with both. One are those people who are openly in both, and they seem to be able to, although it's a tightrope walk as far as I can see, they apparently do it quite openly. The other are those people who feel very strongly attached to a particular body of manifestation that is hierarchical for whatever reasons. They've been in it for a long time. It's sort of like ethnic Roman Catholics. You know, they identify themselves as Roman Catholics even though they may not take the sacraments or have much in the way of belief or don't go to church except maybe on Easter. Nevertheless, Catholicism in America anyway has a kind of ethnicity about it, and some sub-ethnicities like Irish Catholics and Italian Catholics, and they consider themselves Roman Catholics. And likewise, there are those people who are very attached to organizations that they've been with. And since I was with COTO for 20 years, I understand that. I mean, my break was, well, it was messy, but it was clean in the sense that it was complete break. And since the complete break, I have moved even further afield so that I even question their claims of exclusive legitimacy, which I did not even up until the end. All I questioned was being told from the top down what's right and what's not right. That makes no sense to me spiritually or philosophically at all in terms of illumination. And I kind of wandered off. Where was I? Senior moment.
Speaking about those individuals who either do the tightrope walk or have been with these organizations for a considerable amount of time and simply feel at home there.
Yes, about the second group. Some of them are very, very dedicated congregational illuminists, but they're secretive about it. Hmm. And I think some of the people in some of the most authoritarian metaphysical organizations would be shocked to know at what level some of their members are in terms of commitment to Congregational Illuminism. I understand they don't want to, you know, lose face, maybe lose position in those organizations, particularly if they have any close association with me, because I don't know it, but I suspect I'm persona non grata to certain of these organizations because I hope I'm a threat to them. I hope a free alternative to authoritarian structures is perceived as a threat, because it is and should be. It's a radical alternative, a radical experimental alternative to what has historically been the way metaphysical organizations organize themselves. So they may not even be allowed to associate with me, quote unquote. Of course, there are people in other parts of the world that don't have any direct association with me that are associated with Congregational Illuminism, but they may feel that it would cause them grief for a variety of reasons if they were associated with Congregational Illuminism. So they're keeping them in separate pockets, and I don't begrudge that at all.
You've made it really clear in terms of groups and organizations and hierarchical structures, but I'm curious about your thoughts in terms of how Congregational Illuminism fits or doesn't fit with maybe more of a traditional master-student relationship.
I've always been at heart a free Illuminist as opposed to a belief-oriented dogmatist of any variety. I mean, I was raised in Reform Judaism, and that's definitely non-dogmatic and non-centralist.
Mm-hmm.
You count the holy city of Cincinnati, where the Hebrew Union College teaches all the nice rabbis, to be entirely different from one another. But my feeling is that we need to go in an entirely different direction in order to obtain illumination, and that my experience with groups that direct you is that you wind up buying into the group or getting out of the group, whereas there's a third alternative, which is be yourself. But of course, there are the, I'm not sure how to describe it, people who are so independent that they feel they should work entirely on their own. And it has always been my belief that human beings are social creatures, and there is a community element, and that as long as one isn't compromising one's own individual freedom, that sharing and mutual aid are a good thing. In fact, they're a necessity in any successful approach to the great work. So I think that in any period that I've ever been involved in, I've always thought that to be the case. But going back to the original point, I thought that an organized system that invariably, even if it had ad vitam, that is for life, positions, that invariably over time, they changed. They changed leadership. Whereas with a guru type system, you basically had your guru, and that single person, you were dependent on whether they were right or they were wrong. And if they were wrong, you went wrong with them. If they were right, you may have hit their right, but it might not be your right, your correct way. So I favored the COTO system, which isn't, despite its so many people that are owe some kind of personal Crowleyanity loyalty to Aleister Crowley, who is very dead. It really is a system rather than an organization that is built around an individual. If you compare, say, the late Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, what is it without the Maharishi? Well, we'll see. 10 years from now, it's going to look quite different than it looked when the Maharishi was around and living his quite long life. Having said that, I have found that both systems in practice rely on authority. And what I have tried to do is to facilitate a way of approaching these things that more or less guarantees that no one is in charge, that people can influence if they have something profound to say and you think that it's profound, but there is no leader, no head of the organization, not temporarily, not forever. Local bodies, of course, always have the danger that they will have the problem that some Wiccan covens have had, that the person who winds up as head of it is power hungry, and of course you vote with your feet on that. The thing is, if it's part of a vast organizational system, you can't go to another one because they're in communion with one another, or they're actually organizationally bound to each other. The OTO is a corporation, and no matter what a local body seems like, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, whatever the local person is, nevertheless, that's it. And the followers of the late Sai Baba could go to any Sai Baba center anywhere in the world, but it's still the Sai Baba center as long as he was alive anyway. In congregational Illuminism, the person who ordains, consecrates, charters, empowers, whatever, they have that right that every individual has to determine whether to do so or not with any given individual, whether that person is ready for it, able to handle it, whatever. But once given, there's no retraction. And that's a very, very important distinction. Everything is ad vitam. Once given, the other person has it. And my strategy is anything that comes my way that increases my own egregore, and please don't entrap me into trying to define egregore too closely. It's the juice that makes this stuff work. That's all I know about it. It's a fancy word that I think was coined sometime in the relatively recent history for the Orgon or the Odic Force or the Chi or the Prana or the dark energy or whatever. I don't know, but I do know the juice when I feel it and when I pass it to someone. And my intention is whenever something comes my way, I pass it along to others, and I encourage them to pass it along to others as well. Not unprepared people, but people who are prepared for it. And once they get it, it's irreversible. Therefore, I have no power over a person that I have empowered because they immediately have everything that I have, and they may or may not respect me for it, but I would hope that they would. I would hope that they would find it useful and would be appreciative, but I can't take it back, even if they're just, so to speak, fooling me into it and stealing it from me and using it in an entirely different way, which some people have done. And usually what they get, if they're not putting on jackboots and marching around and calling for eliminating the minorities or whatever, they usually do so with my blessing, even if they think I'm an idiot, which in the greater scheme of things, the fool is one of my favorite cards.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I want to get back to some more background information in terms of the movement, if you will. Why do you believe that this type of non-hierarchical cooperative movement is needed at this point in time, specifically, as opposed to in the past?
I don't. I think it's probably always been needed. I think that we live in a time where it's possible to think in terms of non-hierarchical structure. I mean, we can go into the antecedent movements that have no relationship, well, no clear relationship to the metaphysical or the occult or the magical. But suffice to say that when the idea began to develop spontaneously out of the QBLH, out of the heretics of the Northern California OTO, out of the EGNU, and in my own thinking, I think that's just when the idea set in as a realization. As I was trying to find the right way of saying, it's a difficult point. I was always looking for something that was better than the individual teacher who you or guru that you had to entrust your life and your thinking to. And the first thing to occur to me, as I said, was let it be a sort of a predetermined system, a series of Masonic type initiations, which presumably raise you to a higher and higher level. At least that's the intent. What didn't occur to me was to apply to that area of my life, that is spirituality, what I applied to my socio-political perceptions, which is decentralization without authority. I think magic and the occult would be a lot less occult if this kind of decentralist approach had been in use in ancient times and had been the tradition all along. But it hasn't. We come out of societies that were ruled by kings and dictators, and with most of history and most of the world having little or no idea of participatory equal involvement according to one's own abilities and inclinations. And that's reflected in the terminology that's used, and that I will fall into myself if not thinking about it, like the term master, or if you read a list of the titles of Masonic and crypto-Masonic degrees, they're prince of this and sage of that, and according to the OTO system, I'm a prince of Jerusalem, but I don't think I'm going to try to enforce that in reality. And yet that kind of monarchical or aristocratic terminology is very deeply embedded. And the deal is, as far as I'm concerned, that's always been wrong. It's just been true from prehistoric times until, with little bumps in history, like the Athens of Pericles, for the most part, up until the American Revolution. And even there, they didn't quite know what to call the head of government. There was some talk about King George Washington, and whether to call him Your Majesty, Your Honor. I mean, these things in the long run of human existence, which is well over a million years, basically the strong ruled and the others followed suit, or they got killed or beaten up. And that's certainly reflected in spiritual life as well. I wish this had been the way that it was done all along. The point is, for whatever reason, we've arrived at a point now where we're able to do this in a non-authoritarian manner. And because we're able to do it, we should. At least that's my view of it.
What religious movements in the past can Congregational Illuminism be linked with in a philosophical or maybe theological sense?
Well, there are quite a few. And again, we have to keep in mind that there's a relative order here. That is, you won't find a totally decentralist approach in the modern sense that we're talking about here. But you will find predecessor movements, the specific kinds of movements that have influenced my thinking would be during and immediately following the English Civil War, which was what, in the 1600s, there were certain radical Protestant sects, not high church, but predecessors, oddly enough, of the Baptist and Methodist churches and other so-called low churches, during the English Civil War and subsequent to it, we have the development of the Society of Friends, commonly called the Quakers. And even today, you can see a decentralist, tolerant trend. I've seen the Revolutionary Communist Party invited in to have meetings at Quaker churches, and that was reflected in their attitude. They have very definite religious ideas, but as quietists and pacifists and people not inclined to ostentatious titles, they have a generally, in a small L sense, libertarian attitude towards their own spirituality and that of others. There are some that were even more radical and that were burned out. It was a group called the Levelers, who were essentially low church Protestants who wanted to level British society altogether, not just get rid of the notions of the high church bishops and so forth, but to bring equality about throughout society. And then there were the ultra, ultra radical true Levelers who, in some ways, although they were definitely a religious group, they in many ways anticipated the Marxist movement of the 19th century, two centuries earlier. So I think that has some implication. In America, we have the Congregationalist churches, which are independent of one another, even though they have a union. They are a church, but each church is self-governing, and they govern themselves on democratic principles. By the way, that also, in theory, is true of American Freemasonry. They don't elect their Grand Masters for life. They elect them for a year, and they do elect them. You know, it's by the members of the lodge.
Or 3 years in some cases.
Well, nevertheless, nobody is there for life, and the only thing that's sort of for life are the degrees, and they're not seen so much in terms of authority as knowledge. The 33rd and final degree, according to the mainstream masonry, is, I don't know, more of an honorarium than anything else. Possibly an expensive honorarium, I don't know. But basically, for the old guys that have been around for a really long time and have raised a lot of money for those hospitals and stuff.
Yeah, and served the organization in positions that are oftentimes probably thankless. And you're right, it is at least the jewel is expensive from the one I've seen.
Yeah, well, that's true in a lot of organizations. There again, it seems like the regalia and jewels and tools that are necessary in many of these organizations. We have lots of doodads and symbols and outfits and so forth, but no money changes hands in Congregational Illuminism. The closest we get is, since I'm relatively poor and retired stand-up philosopher, as I like to say, if I do a charter, I ask people to send me a self-addressed stamped envelope to return it to them, because all the post offices have moved too far away from me during the current recession, and I can't get there. So I ask them to do that, and if it's an overseas one, I've made arrangement with Tau Isha to ask that they send a return postage via her PayPal, and she picks up the mail from me about once a month for the, let's say, our new affiliates in Ecuador and Panama, which is the most current examples I can think of. And we ask them to send enough money for return postage to her. And if they don't, we still send it back to them. In other words, it's not financial. There is one other religious movement that needs to be mentioned, because it's probably the most important in terms of directly feeding into where we are. So I don't want to leave it out of this picture. That would be the 19th century Gnostic revival movement, which has had a profound intertwining with the occult revival of the late 19th and early 20th century. And through exchanges of consecrations and so forth, has led to a dizzying variety of genuine apostolic and Gnostic successions, and their egregore has gone into many top-heavy organizations, but it has also flowed into our circles. And I have passed that along to even people who are present with us tonight.
Mm. Yours truly.
There is no central Gnostic hope or anything. There must be, out of the established lineages in of the Gnostic and the apostolic sort. I view these things as egregoric as opposed to religious. Some people regard it as both. Some people regard it as their religion. And those are all fine with me. But the point is, when the egregore comes my way, and I encourage others, you know, if they're of a mind to do the same thing, and many do, to pass it along to people who seem sincere and dedicated and ready for that type of thing. No strings attached. And once passed, not only is it passed for keepers, even if you no longer want to be in personal communion with that person, but they can pass it along just as well. That's Augustinian doctrine from way back in the olden times, way back in the beginning of the Dark Ages.
Oh, yeah. The good old days, right?
Well.
I don't know about that, but
you're really in the plague and getting robbed every time you go from one town to another.
No, not really.
I've never found it too exciting myself.
Personally, I find some identification with the German pietists who came to Pennsylvania and settled by the banks of the Wissahickon, Johannes Kelpius and his band of followers. Do you have any thoughts about that and if that might fit in any way or be viewed as sympathetic, perhaps?
I'm not sure. Are they the ones that founded the Harmony and the New Harmony communities?
No, these were mystics and hermits that they were described as Christians, but they wouldn't call themselves Christian. I think many of them came from Rosicrucian circles in Germany, and they basically fled because they were too radical and too mystical, and they just wanted to go into the wilderness, and they would welcome outsiders if they wanted, but it was basically like a group of hermits that were into alchemy and astrology and magic of various sorts.
I'm not real familiar with that. I would suggest if they had a mechanism to pass that along from one generation to the next, that they might very well have fit into the outline that I've given you of preceding organizations and tendencies that would flow towards Congregational Illuminism. There are some, like the Shakers and the people that I just mentioned, the Harmony, New Harmony people, and the Oneida community, who were called themselves Christian Communists in upstate New York, all of whom have essentially, for all intents and purposes, disappeared. The Shakers were so true to their principles that they died out because they were celibate and were not big on conversion. They were somewhat similar to the Quakers, but so they were not overmuch in favor of forcing their ideas on other people or even impinging them on other people, but being celibate, they were successful enough to leave behind some wonderful handiwork, but have, as far as I know, completely disappeared. So that's not self-perpetuating. Mm. The Oneida community was decentralist and egalitarian and had some interesting ideas about sexuality, but then they discovered how to make bear traps, made a lot of money, and today the Oneida community, even though it still exists and Oneida silverware is still a famous thing, it's just another community in upstate New York because money changes everything, as Cindy Lauper once observed, the prophet Cindy.
Yeah, money does change everything for sure. You've talked a lot about your previous experience, not just in this interview, but in past interviews with magical organizations. But how do you characterize your experience with Congregational Illuminism, with the people who are involved with it, the people you've met, your general experience, how you might describe it, compared to the past, to other things you've worked with, to other groups you've worked with?
There are several points. You know, this is something I haven't thought too much about. I'm a lot more comfortable with the people in Congregational Illuminism than I've ever been in any other occult or metaphysical context. And I'm not real comfortable with people, period. I'm agoraphobic, and that makes me have to sort of steel myself to do anything in a group of people or a crowd of people or whatever. But there seems to be a lot less intensity, but paradoxically, a lot more dedication to do the work. That's number one. Number two, there's none of the competitiveness along with the kind of backknifing that I mostly associate with the Chicago Board of Trade or, you know, something, or the New York Stock Exchange, or anything that involves frantic efforts to come out on top and to best other people. It just isn't there because there's no basis for it to be there. As with any metaphysical community, you get the occasional nutcase, and that just happens, and I don't know of any exceptions to that, and Congregational Illuminism is certainly not an exception to that. There are the occasional really off-the-wall people that you wish would go away. Of course, there's no way to make them go away. You are, however, free to express your own impressions. That's everyone's right. But other than that, there's just a relaxed, friendly, we're all in this together type atmosphere, and a refreshing sense of not putting on your Sunday best, so to speak, in order to make an impression on the big kahuna, because there is no big kahuna. And I find it infinitely preferable. There's a subtle pressure, like in an office setting. There is a subtle pressure in the tightly woven, top-heavy organizations to be on good behavior and to say and do the right things. I think it's so deeply embedded that some people would deny it, even though it, in fact, is there all the time. I only noticed it somewhat. I thought of myself as a free spirit when I was in the Caliphate OTO and was a person of considerable rank in that organization, but there was a considerable amount of arse kissing going on at all times, and it was just the nature of things, and I'm as guilty of it as anyone else, and I've been on both ends of it. It's very interesting that there were certain people who were my friends one day, and when I had my falling out with them, were not my friends on the next day. So I guess they were never my friends. That is just nothing comparable to that in Congregational Illuminism. People say what they think. They're irreverent. And yet when we get together to do a healing circle, people know the problems that people can face, the difficulties that come with being incarnate beings, and they take that very, very seriously. And consecrations, a crowd of rowdy people will turn into a very focused group of people rooting for the person being consecrated. So I think that it's sort of the best of both worlds. There is both labor and refreshment, and that's the way it should be, in my opinion.
I agree with that. And I think your description certainly is, you know, I would echo that. It's been my experience as well. And I'll probably edit this out, but I just wanted to mention, I've had some interesting experiences in the same type of situation in a organized group. I didn't set out to challenge the dogma or the mythology of the established organization, but I consider part of what I'm trying to do seeking something resembling truth. And when I would question things that seemed like discrepancies or logical fallacies or things that didn't make sense and timelines that people gave for different things and whatnot, and the reaction I got was always pretty hostile. And it was the most interesting thing was the way the people around me reacted, like when it would happen. I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with that. I think I just felt no, like sharing.
I hope you don't edit that out. I've had the same experience, and I've had other people describe it to me, to the point that people who are fortunate enough, as I was, to stumble into a local lodge of a top-heavy organization that happens to be run by a person who takes it very seriously and who has some sense of community and some sense of responsibility, they're likely to come to me and say, well, what is all this stuff you say is bad? I can't see it. And I say, based on my own experience, ask, and I give them a set of questions. You know, you only need to ask one. One that actually steps outside of the unwritten arena for new folks. And then suddenly there's as if there were a shifting of gears and it turns hostile. It's fine as long as you're playing the game. But the minute you say, my horsey is loose on the carousel, the guy running the carousel says, get off the carousel. Or start shaking it or otherwise complaining about it. It's a very, very dangerous situation, but there just isn't anything comparable in congregational Illuminism. Every now and then somebody comes up with a question that's clearly meant to be baiting, and the most that they will get is an answer, you know, because they have as much right to be there and have an opinion, even if it's a very sour opinion, as I do. It's a very good test, you know. Well, what about, how come there's only one person who gets a salary and everybody else is working for them? You know, dead silence and then, well, you see, you know, suddenly you're the student and they're the master, even though they've only been there 3 months longer than you. But they've gotten the party line down. I've had a lot of experience with little radical political parties. And they operate in the same way. As long as you're seen interested and are considered a good contact and potential recruit, they're very nice to you. But if you happen to stumble across the wrong question, you're frozen out immediately. There are button issues, and to my knowledge, we don't have any button issues.
Well, it's such a radical departure. It's refreshing for me, personally.
Me too, mm-hmm. You know? It's not where I started with this. As I said, I didn't feel inclined to go with a guru. I did not want to be one of those people who learned everything from books and nothing in practice. But you live and learn. And this is the most comfortable I've been. And I also feel a certain sense of doing the right thing. Mm. Since I used to be the head of recruiting for the former organizational affiliation, perhaps I'm undoing some karma.
That's something to think about. So those that consider themselves as connected with congregational Illuminism, yourself included, employ Pointshod as a practical method. You mentioned this earlier. What other types of practical working are you aware of within the larger community, and would it be appropriate for one who's interested in this concept of congregational luminism, but not the points working, to work within the framework of congregational luminism?
100% absolutely. There are groups that their orientation is towards experimentation with the point shot. There are groups whose interest is in doing ceremonial magic. There are an unusually large, maybe because it's the thing right now, like zombies are the monster of the current era, as opposed to vampires who are, you know, sort of receding into the background for the moment. But they'll rise again. It's just their nature. But there are people that are interested in what I would call hard voodoo, as opposed to Gnostic voodoo, which it was part of our fundamental. That's where the point shots derive from. In fact, the Burdio system of point shot elaborated with some considerable input from Burdio at the beginning of it, in order to link it to the degrees of the ancient and primitive rite. There are some that don't do any of these things. There are chartered bodies that more closely resemble a local COTO body than they do, let's say, the Congregational Luminous body that I just visited in Jersey City. And then there are those like that body that combine all of those elements. It has some elements of a classical regular communication of a Masonic lodge. It has elements of Gnostic Voodoo. It does point shot working. It does point shot scrying. We have groups that work with various forms of Kabbalah, various forms of specific Eastern mysticism, and there are eclectic groups. There are groups that resemble Wicca, even Gothic Wicca, especially in Europe. There are groups that seem to follow the high church, Gnostic church position, and are more like ceremonial religious communities, and there are those that are basically just philosophical discussion groups. And there are groups that everything that I've just mentioned is part of their curriculum some of the time. And I'm sure I'm leaving a vast amount of different things out.
Well, that is such a diverse and eclectic list. Even knowing that ahead of time, I'm still impressed to hear you list it.
And it isn't an exhaustive list. I don't have a crib note on that. So I was just thinking about things that came to mind from groups that I visited or groups that have written me to sound me out on whether I know anything about it. And there's a few that are doing stuff that I can't comment on at all because I have no idea what it is that they're talking about. They're just, you know, they're in an area that is either beyond me or just something that I've, you know, completely missed. So there's no one way to characterize it, and there isn't a curriculum. I think the points work is common, but nothing like universal. And there are those that want to do Egyptian rite work without the authority structure that you have in masonry, but trying very, very hard not to step on the toes of Masonic organizations, lest they be considered to be irregular or clandestine Masons. And I don't think anyone has any intention of doing that, but there are people who have greater and lesser sensitivities to that. Everything that we do is experimental by definition. That may be the thing that we most have in common, that we share, that we're mutually supportive, that we want to work in freedom towards illumination, and that we're experimental. Or did I say that in a circle? Well, actually, there's a group of people that are trying to do what they call circular masonry, which is apparently an idea that I set afloat some years ago, the notion that there were originally 360 degrees. It's interesting when it comes back to you through the wonders of the cyberspace universe as interpreted by local groupings all over the world, how it will come back to you with a specific name and a specific idea and a specific approach that never even occurred to you. So it has a certain perverse delight to it.
I don't even know if I would call it perverse.
Well, the way I delight in something, probably most people, if you would have to ask my psychiatrist, I think it probably would be called perverse.
Well, maybe I am and just don't realize it.
Well, that could be. Who am I to judge? That's the point.
I feel most honored to know you and call you brother and to be a participant to whatever extent that I am. I feel, you know, oftentimes like a lurking on the sidelines, but still nonetheless, I do feel, you know, very much connected with this movement and support it. And I'm glad we were able to record this.
You know, Greg, let me say this before we conclude. You're closer to the center of what's happening with this than I am. And here's how. I think that the world community created by the internet is the most, or the availability of the internet and, you know, cell phones and smartphones and other related things is more responsible for the credibility of a decentralist approach to things than anything else. And someone who does the kind of programming that you do out there to, I don't know whether you have a counter on it or whether you can possibly keep count because people also steal. And if you want to call it that, I don't know how many of my books have been stolen. I'm glad for them to be stolen. You know, they come up in PDFs and on pirates, whatever it is, and that's fine with me. The point is, someone who concentrates on making use of this medium is making the profoundest changes in the way people think all over the world, not by forcing their own attitudes on them, but by making available to them a variety of ideas that otherwise would never reach them. And you're reaching people right now. I know because at one time there was a counter on my website, which I wouldn't mind having, hint, hint, but that showed what countries were. I got so many hits from Saudi Arabia, I started to get paranoid to stay with my pistol. But that's, you know, what I'm saying is, much that's happening in the world now is happening in cyberspace. This is the world that all the science fiction writers failed to predict, except maybe Philip K. Dick. And it's, even he always envisioned it as being, you know, androids or big computers or little plastic newspapers that kicked out of your television set every day. Nobody thought this revolution was going to happen. But in reality, for better, worse, or otherwise, ideas are being disseminated all over the world. And this is the medium right here that we're speaking on right now. This is the medium that has supplanted the corporate media. And I don't think there's any way to stop it. I really don't think so. I think it's already set too far in motion for it to be stopped. And it's going to change the world. It is changing the world right now. And you are definitely, you know, even though I've been online since 1985 in the ARPANET days, I'm a writer, not a, you know, not a speaker. I'm fine if I'm being asked questions, but if I had to do an interview show, I wouldn't know how to do it. I don't know how to ask questions except if I'm sitting in a room with somebody. So, I don't consider you on the sidelines. I consider you the essence of the occult personality.
Well, thank you. I do feel like it's a real privilege for me to be able to do this, and I, like you, I do hope that it's having some effect on people and is changing the world for the better somehow. And I think that a lot of it has to do with the people like yourself who I speak with. I don't always agree with everyone, but I feel like the people who are featured here, their viewpoint and what they have to say is important enough that I definitely want to share it. So thank you again, Alan. It's really been an honor and a pleasure to speak with you again.
Same here, but you're going to have to tell me how to turn this damn thing off.
For the Occult of Personality membership section, Tao Alan Greenfield discusses the Great Prague Working, a magical and ecclesiastic tour de force with profound implications with regard to empowering a new generation of European Illuminists. Don't miss it.